Hey everyone, and thanks for listening to the first episode of the new show. I'm so happy to be bringing you a great guest for our first episode here. This is my good friend, Jason Rant. He's the host of the Jason Rant Show on KTTH on 770 AM in Seattle. Jason, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So you live in Seattle, right? So tell us what it's been like in the last few months to live in Seattle in the age of rioting and rest and unrest and looting.
It's probably exactly the way you think it is because you always have something sort of happening at any given time here in Seattle. It's driven by, you know, the unrest that we've seen across the country. You know, the Pacific Northwest and Seattle in particular, I think, is pretty unique in the way that they go about and they get angry. Because they don't just do the vigils, they don't just do the marches, they usually tend towards violence. And what we've seen here is violence being specifically targeting police departments, police precincts, and police officers themselves. And every single time there seems to be a little bit of a lull in the action, something else tends to happen. So it's been keeping us busy and on our toes.
So let's talk about the Seattle area specifically first. So tell me what it was like in Seattle in terms of this unrest before the death of George Floyd.
Well, before George Floyd, there was no real unrest. We're a pretty activist city, so there's always something that folks are talking about. But obviously, when the George Floyd death happened, everything started to change. And it's very interesting because a lot of the focus has been on Portland because there were over 100 nights straight nearly of rioting and some kind of unrest. We followed a very similar timeline, at least from the beginning. So I believe the news of Floyd happened on like May 26th. It was on a Wednesday. Thursday, people were still processing. And then Friday, both in Seattle and in Portland, for the most part, it was just a peaceful vigil. And again, it was focused on not just George Floyd, but they tied in the activists, all the other cases of perceived police brutality. And literally the next day, things got crazy. Things started to get violent. Riots were unfolding. Downtown Seattle was, it literally looked like a war zone. And, you know, a lot of people remember WTO protests in this region, and that was pretty bad. The city never has seen something like they saw on May 30th, May 31st, where this is where footage is still being used when you're talking about rioting during all of this. Mm-hmm. People just completely ransacking downtown Seattle, burning police buildings, stealing wow. high-powered rifles from police cars. I mean, it was wow. pretty intense. And then, of course, what followed was more of the same, despite the fact
so
that we put in place.
Tell me about who was doing this looting and who were the people being most affected by it?
So the people who are doing it are the ones who are, you know, the hardcore activists. We have a pretty significant in the Pacific Northwest in general, both Antifa agitators, anarchists, and others who maybe we can't just...
Antifa, that's fun.
Well, I'm told Antifa doesn't actually exist, but I assure you it actually exists. And people here are not shy about hiding their allegiance to the Antifa movement. And so it's just other people just decided that they were going to take part. I mean, we've been seeing some arrests within the last couple weeks, and some of them are not from Seattle. They're from the city of Edmonds. They're from Tacoma. So they do generally just come and hang out in Seattle because that's usually where these actions are. Now, who did it impact? You know, it impacted a whole bunch of people, right? I mean, in downtown Seattle, we have a lot of businesses, restaurants, and yes, there were some retail stores that are both national chains, not necessarily local. But not only did those businesses get destroyed in the middle of this pandemic, still many have not reopened, but the people who work there were not able to go back to work. And that's really who suffered. And then, of course, it started to migrate out. They got a little bit more targeted over the coming months as to where they were going to go. They went and specifically targeted like the Amazon Go markets, Chase and Key banks. They were going after the Starbucks. And they explained the reason why they're doing it is because, you know, these are national chains. These are not locals. But again, one, that's a stupid argument. This, oh, but not insurance. Insurance isn't quite worth the way I think people think it works. But
no,
it doesn't. They actually employ locals who were then cut from doing their jobs. And so it ends up having an impact on a lot of people, not necessarily the evil, greedy corporations that they think they're trying to impact.
No, Jason, I think that's just your white privilege talking. You're not getting the point, right? You need these Antifa white leftists from out of town to come in and explain to you why trashing urban communities and destroying businesses, minority owned and businesses that employ minorities, that's actually what social justice look like. So I'm glad you brought up the insurance point, because this is a really interesting one. A lot of people have probably seen this online where they're like, oh, it's fine, rioting, looting, no big deal. Companies have insurance, LOL, just property, not people. This is a stupid argument for a couple reasons. And the biggest and most obvious reason is, you know, people get hurt in rioting and looting, and there's a human cost to having your business shut down. But more importantly, also, it's just not true that all businesses have insurance or that they're all covered by rioting and looting. So in your area, in Seattle, what has the business community been saying? Have you talked to business owners who are not going to be covered or are going to be underinsured for the damage?
Well, what we've actually been hearing from the businesses is they're leaving downtown Seattle. We've heard from which is even worse, right? And these are some of them who haven't actually been targeted. But when you take into account the fact that you've got this ongoing violence at the same time that there's this attack on the police department here, and there very clearly is, we're losing staff members at the SPD left and right. And at the end of this year, when we see the stats, because I already know some of the stats that are going to come out, it's going to be historic. And I know that because 2 years ago, I covered a historic departure of police officers simply because they were upset with the way that they were being mistreated by this council. Now, those historic numbers, just to give it perspective, is 110. And that wasn't just 110 officers who decided to quit and go to another profession or just go to another agency. That was all inclusive. So that included retirements. We had, in about a period of a month, we had over 80 applications of SPD officers to go to other departments. And so if those numbers hold up, and a lot of people who I talk to have left and are leaving, like, that's going to be significant. So the businesses have basically said, look, we don't like the direction that the city is going. They've been complaining, frankly, for a while because of our homeless problem and the depolicing that's going on because the council and the mayor's office don't allow police officers to actually do their jobs. So they're starting to just say, yeah, we're out. We're not going to come back. And you know what? It's the best move for them.
Yeah, look, it's hard to blame them, honestly. I mean, if I ran a business and I thought my property could be looted or destroyed, why would I stay there? Why wouldn't I go somewhere that has the rule of law, that has secure property rights? So let's talk a little bit about that, because that relies on the leadership, right, of Seattle. So you've got the mayor, Jenny Durkin, and you've got other people. How did they handle the rioting when it broke out after the death of George Floyd? Unless we'll get into the Chaz Chop drama in a little bit, but just, did they shut it down? Were they permissive? What did they do?
I mean, they were pretty permissive. And, you know, when you get hit, I don't think anyone expected to get the riots the way that we got it. So I give a slight pass coming from at least the mayor's office in that I do think that it took them by surprise. The second night, where it was pretty clear after the first night that it was going to continue, when the SPD was allowed to do their jobs, they got in there fairly quickly to quell. But I mean, it clearly wasn't quick enough because of all the images that we've seen and all the damage that was done.
Right.
I think, again, that there's this ridiculous belief from the mayor that if they have a lot of police presence, it's going to make things worse. But with respect, if police presence makes things worse, what do you think is going to happen when the police aren't there? The people have been pretty open about what their intent was. And to your point, it ends up creating a culture that allowed for Chop or Chaz to be created in the first place. So
tell us about that. Tell us about, right, for people who don't know, this was the anarchist zone that opened in the middle of your city, right? Walk us through the beginning of that and what exactly that meant.
So the very same activists that essentially were destroying downtown Seattle decided to take upon the East Police Precinct. The East Precinct is in a neighborhood called Capitol Hill. It's like a 5-minute drive from downtown Seattle. In a lot of ways, it's like the cultural center, the hub of the Seattle community. It used to be the gay neighborhood, and now it's sort of all-inclusive. And a lot of the activists actually live there. They decided that they wanted to get rid of the East Precinct because they've been trying to abolish the police. That was part of the movement that started with all the activism. And so every single night they were getting in front of the East Precinct with the intent of doing damage. There apparently was, from the FBI, there was some actionable intelligence to suggest that the East Precinct was specifically going to be targeted with potentially deadly violence. So, you know, night after night for about a week, you had a bunch of protesters turned into rioters who were trying to get to the East Precinct, and the cops would not let them. They held their line. They said, look, you're not crossing. You're not getting in front. If you want to peacefully protest across the street, awesome, you can do that. They didn't want to peacefully protest. They were constantly throwing rocks and other items, including bricks, incendiary devices, at the police officers. And SPD reacted with force. They used tear gas. They used pepper spray to disperse a crowd. Apparently, you're not supposed to do that. And we were pretending at that time, they were still pretending, oh, these are all totally peaceful protests. Nothing bad is happening.
Doesn't sound too peaceful.
It wasn't peaceful at all. And anyone who was actually looking at the footage and saw what was going on, they knew pretty quickly what was happening. So what made matters worse is the Seattle City Council on the leadership front, because they don't have any leadership. And the people who are protesting and rioting, this is their base. They showed up to the protest to try to get the SPD to stand down. And things just continue to escalate. And instead of allowing the SPD to go in there and actually make arrests, Mayor Jenny Durkan just ordered them to leave the East Precinct. Now, this is not what the chief of police at the time, Carmen Best, wanted, but it's what the mayor forced to have happen. So guess what happened? They left, and the activists completely took over the area. They called it the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. Signs went up rather quickly, actually bizarrely quickly, and chopped.
And a border wall, right?
Literally, yes, they had border walls all across. Borders apparently are awful when Trump does it, but when progressive activists and anarchists do it, it's
racist,
all good. Yeah,
it's for was
it wasn't racist at this point. So they had, and what was rather weird about this was, not only did they have the border wall, but they had people patrolling it. So the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club, which is an Antifa group, they're armed. Mm-hmm. They were providing the security. Some of them were openly armed. Others were not. Now, we're an open carry state, so stuff doesn't necessarily bother me. But they were checking on people who are coming into the zone, and they're very clear. They're not trained. They don't know how to do security. They're just literally just wandering around. And it became, you know, Mayor Jenny Durkan had called it the summer of love once the president called this out. And any normal human being could have seen what was going on at CHOP, which then became CHAZ, which is the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone instead of the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest. Anyone could have seen what was going to happen. And Durkan didn't want to be seen as siding with Donald Trump. No Democrat wants to do that.
So she was worried about the politics of this. There's a literal anarchist zone in the middle of her city that has taken over.
It's a weird city, man.
Warlord.
Yeah, it really is. It's just a weird city. And so she wanted to play it both ways. I think part of it was because she didn't want to anger them anymore, which is, again, that's not how you treat people who are literally breaking the law and occupying six blocks and a giant park. So what ended up happening is it very quickly devolved into chaos. There were fights breaking out all the time. There was an attempted arson. There was an attempted rape. There was lots of vandalism. And then bam.
Were the police responding?
Police were not allowed to go in. They were told very specifically they couldn't go in. And this was case in point. So there's a business called The Car Tender. It's an automotive shop. And it's inside of the zone. One night, they get an alert on their phone that someone had broken in their security system. So the father and son owner of this shop go in, and they catch a guy. His name is Richard Hanks. He's accused of this, 21 years old. He's trying to set fire to the building. So they catch him before he can do much damage, and they got really, really lucky. They called police between 18 and 20 times, begging them to come down and actually make the arrest. They refused to do it. But who did show up was a mob of the activists. I don't know how they found this out, but they found out something was going on. They demanded that these two people turn over the suspect so they could deal with him. And if they didn't, they would then burn the business down. They ended up breaking down the fencing around this car tender. They broke in. And finally, they essentially say, look, just take him. And so they took control of the suspect, who they physically assaulted. Then there was a brawl that broke up, and then he got away. So it was totally, that's policing in the world of CHOP/CHAZ. And then so not too long after that, there was literally a murder. There was a murder on site.
I was going to ask you how this came to an end and how many days it went on for. How many people got hurt and how long did this last? What finally pushed it over the edge?
So I believe in total, there were 5 people that we know of who were shot. There were 2 murders. One was a 19-year-old and the other was a 16-year-old. Now, after the first murder, which apparently started because the victim ended up arguing over the use of fireworks that they wanted to fire off in the zone, which is, again, very close to apartment complexes. And I guess someone on the ground had said he didn't want that to happen. And then they got into a fight. Shots get fired. He ends up dying. The next day, Jenny Durkin comes out. She holds this press conference. Now is the time. People are done. We got to close this down. Didn't happen. It stayed open. And then there was another murder. And then finally they shut it down. Now the president has said, wow, including this week, that his administration reached out to the mayor's office or the city and said, look, if you don't take this under control, we're coming in tomorrow. And that's when we got word that the mayor was actually cleaning it up and the cops went in early on. We got wind of it. So we knew it was going to happen. And it's still the vocal point of a lot of the activism. There was a case at this point 3-ish weeks ago where, again, same group of activists, they showed up, they used quick dry cement to try to seal shut the door to the precinct while simultaneously trying to burn it down. So they're still doing this. They're throwing Molotov cocktails on a regular basis at this place. It's not safe still.
So tell me what it's like, because obviously you and I are both conservatives. You're a conservative talk radio host, but you live in the city, right? You walk down the street and you talk to people, and it's a left-wing city. So a lot of them are probably Democrat voters. What do they say to this, right? Just your normal people on the streets who maybe they voted for Jenny Durkin, or maybe they are going to vote for Joe Biden, but they've seen this craziness happening in their streets, this violence, a literal anarchist zone. How do they respond to that? Who do they blame?
So here's the weird thing. We're still in the shutdown for the most part. There's not a lot of people just wandering around the streets of Seattle, certainly not the folks who end up getting interested in political conversations for the most part, because it's hot out, they're going down and they're jumping in Lake Union. But for the most part, people aren't really wandering around. Amazon has completely shut down. They're having everybody work from home. And so the neighborhoods outside of Capitol Hill are still pretty quiet. There's definitely been a sense of more people who have said they're just sick of all of it. But Seattle has never really responded after they claim to be sick of something. We just had an election last year with the council after everyone was pretty much disgusted with the way that the city had been run, with a head tax against Amazon jobs, with the homelessness crisis getting out of control. And yet they put almost the exact same people back in office. They made one significant change to someone who's kind of moderate, but not really.
How do you change that? What do you do, right, if you're Republicans or you're conservatives and you want to see a city that I assume you live there, you care about the people there, it's your community. How do you fix this? How do you make this even slightly less of an insane place run with awful leadership? Where do you even begin with that?
The best you can do in Seattle in 2020 is push back against the most fringe voices. You're still going to get fringe voices. The city of Seattle is irredeemably progressive. You're never going to get a conservative on the council or in the mayor's office. You're not going to get a moderate Republican. At best, you'll get a moderate Democrat. Now, we had some moderate Democrats on the council just a few years ago, 3 cycles ago of councils. And every single year, it's gotten progressively more fringe. And so the one good thing about that one council member who is perceived as more moderate, even though I don't think he really is, he defeated an open socialist. It was a little closer than a lot of people would have.
Okay.
But that's really the best that you can do, is try to push out some of the socialist voices. You'll still get stuck with someone who's progressive. But the question is, can you get someone who's progressive who's not going to be completely irrational? That's the best you can do. You're still always going to have a progressive Seattle, and they're still always going to push forward progressive policies.
Are people leaving the city? You mentioned businesses, right? But I can't imagine living in Seattle. I mean, I have friends who live in D.C., and D.C. is nowhere as bad as Seattle. But D.C. has been bad. They've had rioting, and, and Muriel Bowser, she's made a real mess of it. I live across the line in Virginia, so I'm fine. But if I lived in D.C., I'd be looking to move, right? I don't want to live somewhere where my taxes are going to a government that won't even protect my most basic of rights. And I don't know what Seattle's like, but D.C. also basically strips you of any chance of exercising Second Amendment rights or self-defense. So they leave you helpless, and then they refuse to help you. So people, are they getting – the ones who are really sick of this, are they packing up and moving?
So we've sort of anecdotally, we've heard that that's the case. We haven't yet seen any hard data. And to be fair, it's hard to track that kind of data. Yeah. You just get a general sense. And we've been hearing more and more people again saying, yeah, I'm kind of done. We've definitely over, especially, you know, the thing that the pandemic has done is proven a lot of businesses can operate remotely. And a lot of businesses have decided to continue to operate remotely. Amazon is actually, they are very clearly starting to ditch the city of Seattle. The headquarters is here, but just this week, they ended up giving up the lease to another pretty significant property, like 180,000 square feet of office space.
Can't blame them.
Yeah, they're done with it. And the smart hypothesis is that as they migrate over to the city of Bellevue, which is a 10-minute drive, it's just over the water, you know, people are going to go and live in that part of the area as well. So I do think that ultimately you're going to start seeing some people leaving. The question, though, is also, do they get replaced by the folks who like what's going on? Like, do the folks who are inspired by the riots and everything, like, are they going to just move in, come from out of town, right? Because Seattle is very much, these are people who don't necessarily, they're not necessarily from here. Maybe some of them are from the region, obviously. But we're getting a lot of people who come from out of state. Like, do we attract those people? And does, like, that's the scary part. Like, what if Seattle gets crazier? It's like, I don't know how that could possibly be. But, you know, what's interesting, so Shama Sawant, are you familiar with Shama Sawant? She's become a little bit of a national figure in that she's our biggest, most open socialist. And she's on the council. And she really did inspire a lot of folks. And she's got a cult-like following. And I mean that literally. It's very bizarre. So there is a movement right now to recall her, and it's attracted a lot of donors who are giving small amounts of money. Part of it is because if you give under $25, you don't have to report it. And you don't have to report it. People's names aren't attached to it, and they don't want to get harassed. The person, of course, who started the recall ended up getting fired from his job, he says, over this.
Wow.
But people are stepping up. Now, at the same time, there's also a movement to recall Jenny Durkin that's been started by the crazy people on the ground, the activists. So
they're trying to recall her from the left?
She's not far enough to the left.
That's
hilarious.
It
is insane. And the feel like the 17 conservatives who live here, we're also kind of in that weird place. Like, I don't like her either, but do I want the alternative at this point to her? And I don't know.
That's a weird spot to be in. So, yeah. For you personally, I mean, it's got to be a gold mine for you as a conservative commentator, radio host, writer, to live in the middle of this kind of chaos and madness. But long term, do you really think you can stay in a city like this? I don't know if you want to have kids or you want to buy a house, or how could you do that somewhere like this that's just getting worse and worse?
So it is a question that I'm always asking myself, right? So I'm a Seattle talk show host, and I do think that it's important to live in the place that you cover. But, you know, when we talk about Seattle, my show, for example, I'm heard all the way up in Bellingham and all the way into, you know, Centralia and all the way across into almost getting into to Ellensburg. So, I mean, I've got a huge chunk of space that I don't need to live in Seattle. Part of the reason I live in Seattle is, number one, when I first moved here, this is the place that I fell in love with, and it's obviously not the same. Number two, I like the idea that I don't need to even have a car. I can get to work very quickly, and I don't want to have to commute. And so it's just like the practical aspect of just everyday life and going into the office is what weighs on me. But I'm also like, do I want to pay as much as I'm paying for this apartment to, you know, to a council paying in taxes that they're just crazy? I don't know. And so, you know, I'm looking just like Amazon. I'm looking towards Bellevue. Whether or not I end up pulling the trigger and doing that, I don't know. I haven't made up my mind yet, but I am strongly considering it.
So let me ask you about something that I think is interesting, right? Because my first gut instinct was that all the rioting and the looting, that's going to help Trump, right? People are going to look at these Democrat-run cities and say, wow, these people are disgraceful. I don't want to put that party in charge because they're totally abdicating law and order. They're allowing for property rights violations, violence. But I saw something interesting the other day, right? And it was two things, right? One was actually, when you go back to 2014, President Trump tweeted about how the riots in Baltimore were the fault of President Obama, right? Even though obviously he's not the mayor or the city council person. And then at the same time, he promised in 2016 that if he was elected, there would be law and order. There would be no more riots. There would be no more violence, no more Antifa. He made a lot of promises to the effect of, I can stop this. Ultimately, like, policing is a state and local matter. There's only so much that the federal government can even do. So was he wrong to make those promises, or is what's happening partially his fault?
So I don't think what's happening is partially his fault. I think, the whole Trump's America versus suddenly the Biden's America, like that narrative that was created is rather ridiculous. And I'll tell you why. So the main argument that Trump is making right now, and I do think that there's a worry that he could be focusing too much on law and order as the theme without talking about other things, because obviously the economy is incredibly important, coronavirus. He is quietly, in a lot of ways, going to war with these agitators. Just in the last month, there's been like five cases, federal cases charged against these people who have been committing the arsons, for example, here in Seattle. Now, that's not getting a lot of coverage, but the U.S. attorney is going into overdrive in trying to prosecute these people. Same thing in Portland. Now, does that get a lot of coverage? No. Is that happening under Trump? Yes. Would this happen under Joe Biden? Do you get the impression that U.S. attorneys under Joe Biden is going to take this as seriously and go and make these kind of charges? I don't think that. You know, the president has offered services when they've been taken up, however late to the game the mayors have been, it's worked. I don't think Joe Biden does that. But what I do think, and I think this is actually a really strong message that the president has been making more clearly lately, the same people who are in charge right now of the cities that have been dealing with this lawlessness, the same politicians who seem beholden on the left right now to this base of progressives and socialists and anarchists, do you want them in charge of the Department of Homeland Security? Do you want them in charge of literally anything, right? Do you want them to have the ear of Joe Biden? And I would say, no, that's terrifying. And so is this happening in Trump's America? Well, yes, but it's not happening because of Trump. It's happening because of the Democrats who are allowing it. And I think that when you take out the person who's been pushed, the only one who's been pushing back against it, it means you've got a president who's not going to do anything when it's happening, and it's not going to be any real leadership.
So, I mean, you don't have to convince me. I'm 100% on the same page about you that ultimately, like, it's the mayor, it's the governors. And these are Democrats in these cities. They're the ones responsible for policing and protecting their communities. But one thing I do wonder is, both in the coronavirus and also during all of this unrest, right, that was started in response to a genuine injustice. And now we've started talking about a lot of other things. The riots have become a bigger issue than any of the things they were started over. But Trump is not known for his diplomatic, restrained, and calm language, right? Nobody, even his biggest fans, would admit that. I can't help but think that in a time when you have rioting and looting in the street, it would really help everybody if he put the caps lock down and stopped, like, baiting these people on, like, whether it's Ted Wheeler or Jenny Durkin or Antifa. It's like, I don't see how it helps the way that he kind of tweets and talks about these things. What do you think?
I see your point. I suppose I would say my pushback to that would only be, he's been, I think, more reactive when it comes to the individual mayors than he has been proactive, in the sense that he offered help to Portland. He offered help to the mayor of Seattle, right, to Jenny Durkin. And the reaction to that was, no, you're a tyrant. We don't want you here. I mean, Jenny Durkin came out and said the idea that he would bring federal law enforcement officials here to protect federal property in Seattle is him doing a dry run for martial law. So when you're talking like that, with Donald Trump's personality, yeah, he's going to go after you. And I would also suggest that the average American who's looking at this lawlessness, regardless of how they generally vote, if they're a Democrat or Republican, I do think they want someone who's a little bit tough. I don't think they want flowery language to bring all sides together for a hug. Sorry, but when you commit arson, when you try to murder cops, I'm not looking to have a diplomatic relationship with you. I'm looking for police officers to feel empowered to make arrests and district attorneys or, you know, U.S. attorneys making the case and keeping you in jail for as long as humanly possible. I think average people see that. I mean, it's showing up in the polls, right? I mean, whether or not people think it's fair to attach what's been going on, like in the Seattle or Portland or Canoe, wherever, to the Black Lives Matter movement, the perception is that they're attached. Mm-hmm. Polling in support of BLM has dramatically decreased.
Yeah, it has.
I mean, especially when you look in some of the swing states that this is all the election. Donald Trump doesn't care what I say in Washington. He's not going to win Washington. He's looking at Virginia, he's looking at Wisconsin. He's looking at Florida. Like, these are the states that really, really matter. And that's where the numbers are going down, in large part because, like in Wisconsin, they've been directly impacted by the rioting and the looting. And then when you look at Minnesota, same thing. And then, in other words, that's why he's hitting on the suburban issue. Like, do you want this coming to your neighborhood? And weirdly, the folks who say it's racist, that it's code for, do you want black people coming into your neighborhood to loot and riot? Like, actually, the vast majority, at least the position of the people who are looting and rioting, they're white dudes.
You know, I don't want the Antifa white dudes.
They're white. These are white privileged progressives. And the New York Post had a really good story about, you know, showing some of the people who are like in Rochester. These are privileged white people. They're not African American. So the people who are saying that it's racist to point out that, point to a message that says we shouldn't want rioting in the suburbs, saying, well, that means he's talking about black people. No, you're talking about black people, because the people who are actually committing these crimes overwhelmingly on the Antifa side and the agitators, they're white.
Well, and you brought up a good point too, because I think you're a little bit more hawkish on this issue than I am, but I'm someone who very much supports criminal justice reform, right? And so does a lot of Americans, even Republicans, if you look at opinion polls. But it is just a myth, right? I talk to some of my progressive friends and they'll say things like, yeah, rioting is bad, but it's a righteous cause. Or yeah, but you know what? They're to have justified anger.
Yeah, that's crazy ridiculous. People believe that.
Right. But also a lot of just regular Democrats believe that because that's what they're being told. And I think it's wrong for two main reasons. And I want to hear what you think about this, right? One is that the rioting and looting is not a good way to advance a cause. You look at the polls, like you mentioned, it dropped. And you can go back actually to even like the 1960s era, civil rights era riots, and show when and where the protests became violent, support dropped. Peaceful protest works, but violent protest does not. And the other thing, too, is that it almost shifted the conversation away from reform. I don't know, like, maybe you can speak a little bit to how this was in Seattle, but I was watching the national conversation right after the death of George Floyd. And I was like, man, maybe we're actually going to pass a criminal justice reform bill. Maybe something will happen. And then, they're burning down a McDonald's. Yep, that's what everyone's talking about now. Oh, okay, 15 people died.
Yeah,
in these riots after George Floyd's death. That's the story now. And dead is any chance of consensus or reform. Is that the impression that you get?
I mean, yeah, for the most part. But again, even on that topic of criminal justice reform, liberals love to talk about it. Donald Trump was pretty effective in actually passing.
Yeah, I give him credit for first step.
Right? And so I do think that folks are paying attention to that. And I do think that's why you're seeing a shift in the polling for black voters towards Trump. And people, I think it was Stephanie Ruhle, someone on MSNBC made the point of 83% of black support goes to Biden. Yeah, but before it was like 92%. And that 10-point swing, assuming that holds and assuming that that's accurate, that's significant. That's actually how you can-
Monumental.
Yeah, that's how you win elections. No one, especially
with black vote, they'll never win again.
Yeah, so you lose 10% within a year or within 6 months of the black vote. That's insane. That is really significant. No one expects you're going to go from, you know, 93%, 92% voting for Democrats to the opposite, right? That would be insane. But losing 10% of the vote, and, you know, I've been, you know, I have campaign folks on all the time, and I got wind a year ago. So this was obviously well before the pandemic and well before George Floyd and really the Black Lives Matter movement as we now know it, that the Trump campaign was seeing in their data significant shifts amongst young black men towards Donald Trump for whatever reason. Maybe they like the economic benefits that they've experienced under this president. Maybe they like his sort of brash attitude, whatever it is, they started to see that shift. And so when the RNC was talking directly to the black community and had so many black conservative speakers,
they did a good job.
I thought they did really, really well. And I know that like MSNBC and CNN, they're props. They're just doing it to talk to racist white women that to tell them it's okay, you're not a racist if you vote for Trump. I actually don't, that might be part of it, but I don't think that was the intent. I think was the intent was to look at the numbers and try to keep them continuing to stay on Trump's side, to keep the black voters on that side.
Right.
And we've seen just the Latino community, the Cuban American community, they're moving towards Trump in significant enough numbers where it doesn't matter that it's 8 to 10%. It matters that it's like more than 1% or 2%, which is maybe all that you need to win a state.
Right. Well, so, and the interesting thing for me too, is obviously I'm white, so I can't speak directly to this, but if I put myself in the mind of a black or Latino voter, on one hand, you have Donald Trump, who has said some very questionable things about race over the years. On the other hand, you have people who are kind of standing by and sitting on their hands while your communities are being burned to the ground and looted. And also with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, they're not exactly racial justice warriors over their careers, right?
Kamala Harris is a cop.
Especially kind of in libertarian circles, everybody said she's a cop. And I'm saying, don't say that. There's nothing wrong with being a cop. The problem is she was a dirty cop who covered up evidence that would have exonerated people, right? It's not that she was a cop, but she was literally a corrupt cop who prosecuted truant moms and tried to put them in jail. And so it's like, it will be really interesting too, if the president who, and I think sometimes there's merit to some of the criticisms, but the one who they've screamed at racist the loudest for years makes some actual inroads. I mean, he already got more of the Hispanic vote than Romney and McCain, I believe.
Yeah.
If he really makes big inroads into that in 2020, it's just going to shatter the narrative.
Well, and I think the Democrats as a party is making it harder on themselves because, I mean, every year that goes by, they lean more and more into the identity politics of it all. And it is so condescending when you give off the impression that you're not black enough or Latino enough or gay enough or Jewish and Muslim.
Biden literally said that.
And then, he literally says it. And so, you know, you can't sort of go around it and say, you know, I think that's what they're saying and they're implying it. It makes me feel a little uncomfortable. They're literally saying that. And they're still literally saying that. So, you know, I do think that has an effect on someone who is at least trying to be fair. Because if you're in the black community and you saw before the pandemic, obviously, that, you know, the economy is doing well and black unemployment rate is at a really good spot, at least in comparison to where it used to be. And you say, okay, you know, maybe he's not as bad as everyone's. I still don't like him, don't like the tweets. You know, he said some questionable things, but okay, this is actually good. And then you tell that same person, you basically owe your loyalty to the Democratic Party. And if you don't, you're not black enough. I do think for some people, that's enough to push them into the Trump camp, even if they're doing it right, while holding their nose. And again, you just need a little bit. That's why the old Kanye West stunt got some Democrats upset, because they know that literally 1% or 0.5% can actually mean something. Look at Michigan. Trump wins by what, 0.3%? That actually matters.
I can speak to this from a little bit of a different perspective, but I was not a Trump voter in 2016. But honestly, what part of what like made me, obviously I felt conflicted about it, right? And the one of the things that made me want to vote for Trump was the fact that like left-wing gays said that you're self-hating, queer, a traitor if you don't vote for the Democrats. They're going to put you in electric shock cages with Mike Pence. And so it's like, they're so ridiculous that you almost want to just swing the other way. And I didn't end up doing that. And I don't think I will end up doing that. But I can't really blame people when they're literally told by Joe Biden looking into the camera, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. If I was black and someone said that to me, I would not vote for that person.
Yeah, I'm always constantly pushed into a direction that maybe I wouldn't normally go, or at least be open to going, whenever someone tells me I'm not supposed to do it, regardless of the topic. It's not just,
it's just human psychology
kind of in that way. Yeah. I'm not supposed to. Why? Because you don't want me to. Well, how about this? Why don't you let me decide on my own? It just, the pandering, the condescension, it drives me nuts. As someone who's gay and Jewish. And so I'm being told you're not gay enough, you're not Jewish enough, you're a sellout. I get that still all the time, weirdly, from the intolerant left. I've never, and I'm certain they exist, but I've never heard from a conservative who listens to me or reads mm-hmm. me or watches me on TV calling me out because I'm gay or Jewish. I've never gotten that.
Not
that
even on email, Twitter.
Not even on Twitter. Well, maybe.
Because I've gotten some nasty
every stuff. Once in a while. Okay, every once in a while I'll get something on Twitter. Although I will say this, not nearly as vicious as it is from the left. Certainly from the radio perspective, I've never received it. TV, I've gotten it on Twitter a couple times. Mm-hmm. But I mostly get it from folks on the left, and it's the most vicious stuff you will ever see. At least when the conservatives do it, they're not as vicious. They're at least keeping it G-rated in their horrible things that they say. But boy, is it just awful on the left. And again, it's because they kind of feel like I owe them. Like I owe you to be a Democrat, yep. Because straight white dude,
we owe
I wouldn't
them.
Have my rights if not for you. Uh-huh. So, you're a hero.
Let me ask you about this, because this is actually an interesting subject. I have been told now, I actually don't drink alcohol. That's something that not everyone knows about me. It's just a personal choice. So I don't go to bars in the first place. But I've been told many times now that if I show my face in one of the DC gay bars, that I will be kicked out, confronted. They've said, don't make sure he's not welcome. All sorts of stuff. I don't know. Are you involved in that at all? Like, do you even go to those places? And have you ever encountered that in real life?
So people definitely know who I am. They recognize me. I don't know if you can tell. I have very dramatic eyebrows. And so it's very easy to spot me. I will get that every so often. It hasn't been awful, mostly because I'm usually with other people. So I think it's a little bit hard to do that when you're with others. Definitely in my coverage of some of the riots, I've been spotted and it's not been very good. And I have to make, you know, considerations as to which ones I'm actually going to go to versus, you know, pull up streams for.
Wow.
I will say that it's gotten certainly easier because of the pandemic, where if I put on a hat and you put on the mask and you got sunglasses on, it is very difficult in a group of a lot of people for them to spot me. And so that's the
way. How crazy is that? You have to hide.
I know. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the ones that I don't have to hide is when the cops are actually there, because the cops love me. And they've got my back. They're not going to let them go ahead and like kill me. So that's always a positive. But it is kind of weird, and you're always kind of thinking about it. And I've definitely got looks. I will say, and I'm always shocked by this, and this is like a weird humble brag, but it's not real. I get a lot of people who recognize me and are fans. And in Seattle, it's shocking because I know if I go into Snohomish County or Pierce County, those are my people, right? Ideologically speaking, those are my people. And they're huge fans, and I expect that. In Seattle, you know, I'm walking, and a jogger walks by, and they just, like, points at me, and I'm always immediately thinking, oh, my God, he's about to hurt me. And I pull up my headphones, and it's a fan. And someone the other day actually scared the hell out of me. I've never been more terrified in my life. So I'm walking. I get the feeling like a car is following me, because it's just driving slow, and I just kind of notice it, and then speeds up, stops very, very fast, and I thought she was going to run me over, and it turns out she's a fan who saw me on Tucker, and I was like, oh, my God, I've never been more terrified in my life, though. I legitimately thought she was going to run me over. And so in the back of my head, I'm always thinking about it. But so far, thank God, nothing has happened. Knock on wood.
Well, yeah, we hope you stay safe out there, especially since you're going to have to keep covering Antifa and rioting in the streets. And anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show. And for everybody listening, you can find Jason on Twitter at Jason Rants, RANTZ. And he's the host of the Jason Rants Show on KTTH in Seattle. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I hope this was an amazing first get for you, because I'm kind of a big deal.
My next guest aren't going to have the eyebrows.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right, guys. That's it for our first episode, and thank you so much for listening. If you want to support the show, make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Spotify. And with that, I'll talk to you all next week.